VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Fireworks sparkled in the night sky over Nairobi as Kenya welcomed the arrival of the new year. The capital was one of numerous cities around the world to herald 2025 with a spectacular light show that lit up the dark skies. Johannesburg's skyline was illuminated by thousands of fireworks as South Africans greeted 2025. Hong Kong welcomed the arrival of 2025 with a dazzling fireworks display over Victoria Harbor. Crowds in Dubai celebrated the new year with a spectacular fireworks display and drone show. Syrians welcomed in a new year with many hoping for a promise of a brighter future after the unexpected fall of Bashar al-Assad's government weeks earlier. Hundreds gathered in Damascus to sing, dance, and watch a fireworks display, many looking forward to a new beginning after the ousting of Assad. Many world leaders released messages marking the new year, including Russian President Vladimir Putin, who praised Russia's military in his pre-recorded address to the nation. Putin ensured Russians that everything will be fine as the country enters the third year of fighting in Ukraine. While French President Emmanuel Macron acknowledged in his New Year's address that his decision in 2024 to dissolve Parliament backfired, but Macron also used his address to celebrate last summer's Paris Olympics. A blackout hit nearly all of the Caribbean island of Puerto Rico on Tuesday as the U.S. territory prepared to celebrate New Year's. This is VOA News. The U.S. announced on Tuesday it is imposing sanctions on Russian and Iranian groups over efforts to target American voters with disinformation before last month's election. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
American intelligence has accused both Moscow and Tehran of trying to manipulate voters and undermine trust in elections. The Treasury Department says these sanctions are on organizations that work to stoke divisions among Americans. It says the Russian group's director worked closely with Moscow's military intelligence and that the Iranian group is a subsidiary of Tehran's Revolutionary Guard. U.S. intelligence officials say while Russia tried to prop up eventual winner Donald Trump, Iran tried to oppose him. Both nations say they did not try to influence the election's outcome. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The U.S. Treasury Department says Chinese state-sponsored hackers broke into its systems in early December. Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner reports.
According to a letter to lawmakers obtained by Reuters, the Treasury called the breach a major incident, saying department workstations were remotely accessed and documents were stolen. It said the hackers compromised third-party cybersecurity service provider Beyond Trust, gaining access to a key used by the vendor, and were able to retrieve unclassified documents. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Mao Ning on Tuesday called the claims groundless and lacking evidence. A spokesperson for the Chinese embassy in Washington also rejected any responsibility for the hack. The Treasury Department said it was alerted to the breach by Beyond Trust on December 8th, and that it was working with the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, as well as the FBI, to assess the breach's impact.
Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner. A team of U.S. investigators, including representatives from American aircraft maker Boeing, on Tuesday examined the site of a plane crash that killed 179 people in South Korea. Authorities, meanwhile, are conducting safety inspections on all Boeing 737-800 aircraft operated by the country's airlines. All but two of the 181 people aboard a Boeing 737-800 operated by budget airline Jeju Air died in Sunday's crash. The plane was seen having engine trouble, and preliminary examinations have revealed the pilots received a bird strike warning from the ground control center and issued a distress signal as well. But many experts say a landing gear issue was likely the main cause of the crash. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Today is Wednesday, January 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ugandans celebrate the new year amid political tensions between President Museveni and the opposition.
The costs to African countries in terms of higher interest rates and also in terms of lower development financing inflows for the 19 countries we surveyed came up to about $74 billion. That's more than the total amount of aid that African countries receive on an annual basis.
That's a financial expert talking about how some 20 African nations are bankrupt or close to it as they enter the new year. And Zimbabwe's president signs into law a bill that abolishes the death penalty.
The president, the personal role he played in moving matters in that direction, and this arising from his own historical experience as a prisoner who had been condemned but only survived on the basis of age. But we want to situate this decision as a decision of parliament.
Uganda celebrated the new year with firecrackers and pop music as President Yoweri Museveni promised to tighten security and expand the economy. But opposition leader Bobi Wine blames the government for not doing enough and is calling on the government to stop abusing human rights. Reporter Megumi Davis Rakarunj has more from Kampala, Uganda.
The sound of fireworks rippled through the nighttime sky as Ugandans ushered in the new year in the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
My name is Semakula Mathias. 2025, I want to settle with my wife.
Nambi Brenda. It has not been an easy year, but we have overcome. We have lost so many dear ones in 2024. But we hope 2025 will be a great year.
My name is Dennis from Kampala, Uganda. 2025, I have to do the undone things. I have to upgrade my education.
In his end of the year address to the nation Tuesday, Ugandan President Museveni said the year 2024 was a bright one for the country, despite challenges such as landslides that killed hundreds of people and the terrible attacks that killed dozens of students in Kasese District, which borders the Democratic Republic of Congo. He said Uganda's exports, in particular coffee, have increased.
We are now adding irrigation in order to increase the yield and stability of crops and livestock production. It is not only coffee that has done well. Many other crops and livestock activities, as well as industrial products and services, have done well.
Museveni pledged to improve peace and stability in the coming year, 2025. He said his government will be tough in enforcing law, including scrapping the police bond, a guarantee that those who have been arrested will show up again when required. Uganda opposition leader Robert Kyagulanyi, popularly known as Bobi Wine, the former pop star, castigated the government for not doing enough during his end-of-the-year address to the nation.
We've again seen rising abductions in Uganda. Very unfortunately, we've exported the same nasty habit to even our neighbors in Kenya. We've seen so many abductions. Many of our people are still missing. But the most recent is the abduction of Dr. Kizza Besigye from Kenya. Dr. Besigye and Haji Obedi Ntare from Kenya. They were illegally abducted from Kenya, brought to Uganda against international law.
Besigye has on four occasions contested against President Museveni. He was abducted from Kenya in November and paraded before a military court. Bobi Wine, the leader of Uganda's largest opposition party, the National Unity Platform, is expected to run again against Museveni in 2026 elections.
That is Megumi Davis Rakarunj reporting from Kampala. At least 20 African countries are bankrupt or at high risk of defaulting on debt repayments as they enter the new year, according to global financial institutions. The reasons, say economists, include the COVID pandemic, global conflicts, and corruption. Darren Taylor reports.
A recent United Nations report unpacks how Africa's debt challenges are retarding its development, preventing it from spending adequately on health, education, and infrastructure. The World Bank says Africa's external debt has climbed to more than $650 billion, and debt servicing costs reached nearly $90 billion in 2024. In 2025, according to the bank, the continent will be expected to pay almost $100 billion to external creditors, including the International Monetary Fund, the United States, France, and Germany, and private lenders spread across the globe. Then there's China, by far the biggest holder of African debt. The UN says the continent owes China's public and private lenders around $85 billion. Angola alone, it says, owes Chinese lenders $21 billion, with Kenya and Ethiopia each owing China almost $7 billion. UN Development Program Chief Economist Raymond Gilpin says African countries pay more to borrow because ratings agencies label them high risk, often without proper analysis.
When this is not done, the cost to African countries in terms of higher interest rates and also in terms of lower development financing inflows for the 19 countries we surveyed came up to about $74 billion. That's more than the total amount of aid that African countries receive on an annual basis. You look at the interest rates that African countries, some of the poorest in the world, pay about 12% on average, while the developed world interest rate is about 3%. Today, over 700 million Africans live in countries that pay more in terms of debt servicing than they pay in terms of investing in health and education. Bottom line here is that countries that could afford it less are paying much more, and that doesn't seem right.
Gilpin was speaking at a live virtual event at Oxford University earlier this month. At the same event, Cameroonian financier Alain Nkonchu said African countries cannot afford to repay loans at the exorbitant interest rates international lenders demand.
We are now having, when we had, some default that actually happened. We have Zambia, we have Ghana, more or less Ethiopia on the brink, and this is the dynamic within which we are now.
For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Zimbabwe's president signed into law on Tuesday a measure that abolishes the death penalty. Columbus Mavunga has that story from Harare.
In an interview with VOA, presidential spokesman George Jaramba said President Emmerson Mnangagwa has not signed death warrants for those facing capital sentences since he came to power in 2017, confirmed that his boss signed the death abolition bill into law on Tuesday.
Yes, the president had a personal role he played in moving matters in that direction. And this arising from his own historical experience as a prisoner who had been condemned but only survived on the basis of age. But we want to situate this decision as a decision of parliament.
Mnangagwa survived a death sentence during the colonial era in the 1970s as he was considered underage to face the gallows. Edwin Mshoriwa, an opposition member of parliament, introduced the death abolition bill, and parliament, which dominated by the ruling ZANU-PF party, accepted the idea. He was elected Tuesday, speaking to VOA.
We are happy the milestone that we have achieved. The reason why I had to bring that bill is actually to do with the fact that out of the 62 inmates in remand prison today or on the death row, the majority of them come from the poor background. Secondly, death penalty by nature is not part of our culture as the Africans, as Zimbabweans. It's a penalty that was brought during the colonial era. So I can't believe that the death penalty is not proper.
Several human rights groups have been calling for Zimbabwe to abolish the death sentence penalty. Pervez Jeba, the executive director of the London-based NGO called the Death Penalty Project, said Zimbabwe had now joined two-thirds of the world that no longer use capital punishment as a lawful sanction.
In fact, In the African Union alone, there have been a number of countries that have abolished the death penalty in recent years, so there is clearly an African movement taking place in relation to this issue. I'm also encouraged by the government's statements about respect for human rights in abolishing the death penalty, and I hope it will be taken and seen as an opportunity for further reforms in the area of human rights. This should not be seen as the end, but the beginning of wider reforms. I also hope this will provide a stimulus for other countries in the region to also consider abolition, countries like Kenya and others.
But not everyone is happy with the bill. One of them is Vincent Mazlankata, an artisan miner, who says deaths have risen in his area of trade since the bill was discussed.
If you just look at how people are killing each other, especially in the mining areas, that's when you see that death penalty was supposed to remain in place, because before people were so afraid that if you kill, you're going to be hanged. So I think it's not good at all. This act was supposed to be there and to remain in place as just a deterrent, because before talking about the abolition of death penalty, people were not killing each other like what they are doing now. Imagine a person who has killed someone and gets 20 years imprisonment, and that person is 21 years. When he comes out, he's 41 years. Then life goes on. It's not fair at all.
Amnesty International says Zimbabwe now joins 24 countries across sub-Saharan Africa that have abolished the death penalty for all crimes, while two additional countries have abolished it for ordinary crimes only. Zimbabwe's last known execution was in 2005, though courts continued to impose death sentences for all cases of murder committed under aggravating circumstances. Columbus Mavungam, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam, filling in for James Buddy in Washington. Today is Wednesday, January 1st. Happy New Year's, everybody. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Coming up on our program, we will hear about how it's not been a very good year for children globally, especially in Africa. An uneasy calm hangs over Chad, where the opposition is calling for an immediate end to the country's transitional government and the cancellation of the December elections, which the opposition says were highly boycotted. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from neighboring Cameroon.
L'Agence Nationale de Gestion des Élections.
This is the voice of Assane Baira, Vice President of Chad's National Agency for the Management of Elections, or ANJ. She tells reporters in Chad's capital, N'Djamena, that vote counting is underway after the Central African State's local, provincial and parliamentary elections on Sunday. The elections were scheduled to end Chad's three-year transition period following the death of longtime President Idriss Déby Itno in April 2021. The late president's son, Mohamed Idriss Déby, was declared the winner of the presidential election in May. Provisional results for these latest polls are expected by January 15, Ange says. Assane said Ange has successfully executed its mission of ending the transitional period by organizing free, fair, and transparent elections. The elections body says about 36% of Chad's estimated 8.3 million registered voters took part in Sunday's polls. But opposition parties maintained that turnout was much lower, saying that civilians respected opposition calls for a massive boycott. Avoksuma Jonah is a spokesperson for Chad's Political Actors Consultation Group, or GCAP, a coalition of several dozen political parties. He spoke on Monday during a press conference in the capital.
Le peuple tchadien, ne sachant pas avec exactitude.
Avoxuma said more than 90% of about 8.3 million registered voters adhered to GCAP boycott calls because civilians learned from Chad's May 6 presidential elections that Deby wants to confiscate power and extend his late father's long rule. He says Chadians are angry because Deby is a dictator who silences all critical voices. In a statement Monday, Success Masra, president of the Transformers, one of Chad's leading opposition political parties, called for a new transition, which he said should be marked by truth, dialogue and reconciliation to lay the foundation of a stable and inclusive political system. Masra, who served as prime minister under transitional president Deby, says ongoing tensions in the Central African state may degenerate into violence and social strife. Avoxuma said he is very certain that despite the massive boycott, Ange will still proclaim Deby's ruling Patriotic Salvation Movement as the winners of the December 29 elections. Ahead of the vote, opposition parties accused Deby of rigging the elections, a charge Deby denies. Yemenge Batinbaye is a political analyst at the University of N'Djamena. He spoke to VOA on Monday via a messaging group. The analyst told VOA that although the opposition has legitimate claims that the boycott was massive and irregularities, including the stuffing of ballot boxes to rig elections for Deby Meni, it is unlikely that the polls will be annulled as the opposition requests. The Chadian government says calls for the elections to be annulled and for a new transition are intended to cause chaos and sink Chad into violence. The government says civilians should not obey opposition calls to destabilize their country by going out onto the streets to protest. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
2024 was not a good year for many children worldwide. UNICEF says it was one of the worst for children in conflict zones, including Sudan and parts of the DR Congo. More children than ever before are living in conflict areas or forcibly displaced due to violence. UNICEF says there were more than 33,900 grave violations committed against children in 2024. I asked Joseph English, UNICEF's emergency communication specialist, in part two of our conversation, if the perpetrators of those crimes are ever arrested.
I think the reality is with accountability around these kind of crimes is that it is a long process and that there are obviously bodies in place that it is their job to look at these and then to go through that process. But what we're saying is that we can't wait for those processes to play out. We have to be proactive. And so for UNICEF, our mandate is clear. We are for every child. And so what we are asking for is for parties to change their behavior now. Not to wait to see if there are going to be, recriminations further down the road. For parties to say, we will take the stand and protect children and ensure that they are protected, as we have agreed under international humanitarian law.
Women and girls have been used as weapons of war in conflict zones, as you know, for years, and it seems to have ramped up a lot more in 2024. It's happened in Sudan and elsewhere. Has UNICEF been able to talk to any children who have been the victims of this? And if so, what are some of their stories?
We have, and sexual violence against children and women in war is one of the most abhorrent, horrifying, issues within conflict. And it really, really has a lifelong impact on many, many women and children. And so, from in a place like Sudan, yes, we have seen widespread reports of absolutely horrific instances of violence against women and children. And we actually have a report coming out early next year, which will shine a light further on that. But the parents that we speak to and the children that we speak to, they want one thing, which is that quiet miracle of a normal life. They want to be able to go home. They want to be able to have their kids in school. They want to wake up believing that tomorrow will be better than today. And that's what we do every day, is to try and make sure that happens. And obviously our humanitarian support, providing psychosocial care and providing access to the basic necessities of life, is part of that. But none of this can really happen whilst conflict is still raging, whilst women are still threatened by sexual violence and rape, whilst, you know, there are bombs falling and schools being damaged and destroyed and hospitals being damaged and destroyed. That has to stop before we can really help children and families rebuild their lives.
I suppose your last that answer could be applied to this last question, but what is your message from UNICEF to the leaders of nations and their military commanders who have been involved in these kinds of grave violations with conflict zones?
Yeah, the first message is one which we repeat ourselves again and again with, but we continue to call on all parties to conflicts everywhere around the world and all those who have any kind of influence over to ensure that children are protected, to adhere to the rules of war, to make sure that the children and the basic structures of life, whether it's schools or hospitals or access to humanitarian support, that is protected. But secondly, you know, on a personal level, it's for each and every one of us to understand, to recognize that each and every one of the children who are affected by these are our children. They are no different from you know, your own children or your nephews and nieces or your, you know, friends and family. You know, these are kids who have the same hopes, the same dreams, the same, you know, the same games that they play out in the street. You can be anywhere in the world and you will see kids being kids. And it is heartbreaking when that happens, set against, you know, the rubble from damaged and destroyed buildings, or you meet children who have been killed, or you meet children who have been injured and are now in hospital with, you know, the loss of limbs, or you meet parents whose children have been killed. All any of them want is peace and the chance to rebuild their life. So that is the call. You know, 2024 was an absolutely devastating year. 2025 cannot be worse. It cannot, because we cannot say we do not know what is happening. You know, it is absolutely critical that we say enough is enough. This cannot be the new normal.
That's UNICEF spokesperson Joseph English speaking with me from New York. Voters went to the polls in more than a dozen countries in Africa in 2024. While some longtime dominant ruling parties retained power in some places, incumbents suffered crushing defeats in others. VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo has more.
Some of the election results this year in Africa were expected, and others were surprising. In Senegal, for example, election uncertainty turned into a historic accomplishment as opposition leader Bassirou Diomaye Faye was elected, and at 44 years old, he became Africa's youngest president. His election victory came after a failed attempt by outgoing president Macky Sall to postpone the election process, creating a brief political crisis in the country. Analyst Teddy Kabiruka says lessons can be learned in the Senegal case.
It's really interesting, a very educative scenario for people who are learning democracy.
In Ghana, after serving only one term about a decade ago, John Mahama made a stunning comeback in 2024 and beat the country's vice president and ruling party candidate, Mahamudu Bawumia.
This mandate represents many things.
Analysts, including Kwame Asa Asante, told VOA that many voters in Ghana were thinking about the economy and their families' financial situations when they cast their ballots.
Because it's a bread and butter issue. Anytime, we've seen time and again that anytime you have a very difficult economy, campaigns become difficult for the government of the day.
Mahama vows to improve an economy which is slowly recovering from a $30 billion external debt default in 2022.
I, Juma Gideon Boko, do swear.
Botswana ushered in a new era by electing a leader from the opposition for the first time in nearly 60 years, following decades of rule by one party. Unlike Botswana, Mozambique's Frelimo party won again after nearly 50 years in power. Results were immediately rejected by opposition leader Venancio Mondlane, who came in second place, triggering violent protest in the southern African country. American University's Kweku Nwama hopes Frelimo's Daniel Chapo can extend an olive branch to the opposition to avoid a prolonged conflict in Mozambique.
When you win, you have a responsibility to unite a country. And so hopefully he's able to do that. We don't need another African country going down in flames.
Similarly, Namibia's ruling party SWAPO retained power after many decades of governance, but made history by electing its first female president, Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's it for this Wednesday, January 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending New Year's Day with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. On behalf of the entire Daybreak crew, I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, wishing you a